Radio.
The Beauty and Inspiration of the Bible, a series of talks on the Bible in Contemporary Scholarship by Dr. Robert Tilley at St. Francis of Assisi Parish in Paddington, Sydney. This second talk is entitled, The Big Things of Heaven Find a Home in the Small Things on Earth, The Prophets and the Unexpected.
Okay, look, just to recap a little bit. Last week, as I pointed out, in the last 40, 50 years especially, there's been a rediscovery of Hebrew narrative devices. And these Hebrew narrative devices can be said to operate often, you could say, on the model of the sacred text being as a temple. And the temple was one made up of a graded approach. And as you went further and further in, of course, you came closer and closer to the Holy of Holies, to the presence of the glory of God. And thus, we can say that the Bible is as a temple that, as it were, houses the presence of the glory of God. But in what way? And in what way do we go from one level to another? Often, what is spoken of in the, like I said, in the last 30, 40 years, is what I would call exegetical prompts. Exegetical prompts. And what this means is often what earlier scholars thought were just plain contradictions. And because they were contradictions, they represented different sources rather inexpertly put together. But we know that that is not the case. We know, and this includes even those who want to defend old-style modern biblical criticism, will even acknowledge now that yes, contradictions in ancient texts are not quite what we think them to be. That theme of the temple is very important because it informs a conceptual background of thinking. This is something actually been long known. It's not anything new. The temple was like a microcosm of the macrocosm. That is, of the cosmos. So the temple represented a microcosm of the macrocosm. The temple in the ancient Near East and in many other cultures, obviously the Greek culture, as with Mount Olympus, the temple could also represent the Holy Mountain, of course. And the Holy Mountain was a temple insofar as you approach the top, you go through the grades. And consequently, it's not something I'm going to go into, but for example, in certain of the Psalms, certain collections of the Psalms are structured in such a way that they create something like a mountain. Now, again, this is something that we're rediscovering. As I said, in a way, all humanity's journey in the Bible is presented as a journey from Eden to the New Eden. The role of Israel in the Torah is presented as a kind of recapitulation of humanity's journey. And that theme of recapitulation is a very important factor and logic in the history of Israel. It's also a very important factor in the history of the temple. For as the temple is like the mountain, we get a representation of that in the Torah, in Exodus. For example, around the mountain you have, as it were, the laity. Midway up you have the 70 elders. A little bit further up you might have Moses and Joshua. And then furthermost up you have Moses at the top of the mountain, representative of the high priest, who in the temple was the only one once a year who could enter into the very presence of God. This is important for where we're beginning tonight. The journey is as a journey up the holy mountain, and it's an interesting point in the Torah that three times, let us just say here, the covenants are fulfilled on mountain tops or made. Obviously, Noah on Mount Ararat, Abraham on Mount Moriah, and of course, Moses on Mount Sinai. And of course, in Christianity, Jesus on Mount Zion. The rabbis also held, and this was something too that some of the church fathers picked up on, the rabbis also held that Eden, being the Holy of Holies, was likewise on a mountaintop. They held that Eden was on a mountaintop. Again, this is something Ezekiel picks up in his vision of the New Jerusalem as a new Eden. Thus, the covenant with Adam would also have been taken place on a mountaintop, Eden. As I say, that theme of the mountaintop is very important. I mean, quite plainly, I guess the world wide over, I suppose it's a kind of universal phenomena that suggests itself, that the mountaintop always evokes a sense of transcendence. You climb up, and then at the top, there's no further to climb, and there's a sense of that which is beyond. The graded ascent culminating in what is beyond. And therefore, the experience of the uncanny, and thus of the beautiful. Indeed, the experience of terror. And this brings me to what is called by the rabbis the Akedah. Sometimes it has a U in, but sometimes not. The Akedah. And what this refers to is this, is Genesis 22. It's about God's command for Abraham to kill the son of the promise, Isaac. Isaac would have probably been about 13, 14 years old by that time. It's a very interesting story. If you remember, it's very succinct, like a lot of Hebrew narrative. Like I said, if you could read Genesis and think this is Sunday school stuff, and a lot of people have read it that way, but if you actually pay attention to the structure, something very different appears. And Genesis 22 is an especial case in point. What occurs, of course, is that God calls Abraham and he says, "Here I am." Now, in the whole story, that repeats three times, which is a very important structure in Hebrew narrative. "Here I am." God says to Abraham, "Well, I want you to kill your son, to sacrifice your son." Abraham says nothing, which in itself is really odd for reasons that I'll come back to in a minute. Abraham says nothing. In fact, there's a strange silence about Abraham. And for 3 days he journeys through to Moriah until he sees the holy mountain, Mount Moriah. And then it says he lifts up his head and sees it. The Hebrew narrative gives you to understand that for 3 days Abraham stayed silent, his head lowered. What was it that he was thinking about? Anyway, he says to the two young men who are with he and Isaac, "Stay here, we will be back soon," meaning, in a way, he's misleading them. As they're climbing up the mountain, Isaac says, "Well, I can see you've got the fire and you've got the stuff. Where's the sacrifice?" And Abraham says, "Don't worry, God will provide the sacrifice." Again, the implication is Abraham has not told anyone. He's kept this to himself. What was he thinking as he was going up? He binds Isaac, and just as he has a dagger lifted up, suddenly an angel of the Lord appears and says, "You know, you've passed a test," and there's a ram caught in a thicket. Well, why this silence? Because you see, in Genesis chapter 18, that's a famous one where God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and God famously bargains with God. "If there are 50 righteous people, will you spare it?" "Yes, I will." "40. Yes, well, look, what about 30? Yeah. Sorry, I'll take it. 20. Yeah, 10. Yes. In fact, Abraham's not a silent person. And even after this event, he haggles over gravesites with certain Canaanites. Now, those events are put there by the Hebrew writers in order to tell you the nature of the character. It's not like a modern novel or certain modern novels that will tell you everything that's going on interiorly. It tells you about the kind of person through certain events it tells you about. Why the silence? Well, all through Genesis 22, there's an uneasiness. It's a terrible passage. It's a terrible passage. I know at the opening mass at the Catholic Institute of Sydney this year, where the cardinal was presiding, this was the reading. And the cardinal said that he had great troubles with it because God is a God of justice, and he certainly could not get his head around this because it seemed to go contrary to everything one understands about God. Now, another very, very important text on this is, probably the most important modern text, is Soren Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. It was written in the 19th century, and Kierkegaard was one of the great first modern existentialist philosophers in the 19th century. He was a Protestant, but fell out a lot with all his fellow Protestants, and he was writing against this idea that you could neatly sum up religion by a set of rationalist ideas derived from the philosopher Hegel. And he said, in Fear and Trembling, he said, everyone thinks that they have faith and they can go beyond faith when Abraham is just a man of faith. And what does this mean? And he goes to Genesis 22, and it's an amazing book. It's in Penguin Classics, so it's easy enough to get. It's an amazing book because he says, what was Abraham thinking for those 3 days? What was he thinking? And Kierkegaard says a little story. He talks about a good Protestant pastor who ministered giving a talk about Genesis 22, saying, this is what faith is. Abraham was a man of faith who was ready to sacrifice to kill his only son. And a member of the parish goes home, this fellow, gets his son, binds his son, and kills his son. The police come, they're horrified by this crime, and the fellow says, well, I was doing what the pastor said. And of course, what? So they bring the pastor in, and the pastor is horrified and says, well, how dare you say I would ever recommend or say something like this? But what was he saying? And that's Kierkegaard's point. His argument was that Genesis 22 defied expectation, defied rationality and even morality and piety, that it was something terrifying, that it was fear and trembling, that here you were at the height of the pinnacle of the mystery of God, and there was a beauty. But as you remember last week, if beauty does not have a certain element of fear, then it is simply kitsch, sentimentality. Now here's the other interesting thing. It is such a strange passage. You would think that certain of the other texts in the Old Testament would mention it. And except for what might be a mention, I think, in Zephaniah, which I do not think is a mention, and most don't, but some do, there is no mention, at least explicitly so. At least explicitly so. There's no mention. And when we come to what is called the intertestamental period, that is from around 300 BC to 200 AD, we have lots of other Jewish and early Christian texts from this period that aren't in the canon. And when we look at, say, some of the Jewish literature and the rabbinic literature, one of the ways that they handle this text is to say things like, it really wasn't God, it was the angel Mastamah, an evil angel. Others say, Abraham told Isaac that this is what God commanded, and Abraham said, I'm not going to do it. But Isaac insisted and said, yes, do it, because when you slay me, I will be taken up to the right hand of God, and I will be able to intercede for you and everybody, and my fame and everything will increase. In other words, they knew there was a problem, and they were trying to explain it. Well, the other interesting and fascinating thing is this. Where is Mount Moriah? Well, the rabbis gave it some thought and they concluded Mount Moriah was Mount Zion, on the place of the Jerusalem temple. Well, a I said last week that, in my opinion, is that, yes, the Torah contains earlier documents, not least the Book of the Law by Moses, and that it reflects through and through a priestly cosmological structure. But I also would argue it's written by a prophet, largely because what we see of biblical prophets is that they were concerned with history, if you remember, and they concerned with reflective critique on the corruption and pretensions of those who hold, be it government office, military office, or priestly office. And thus, they are concerned with the abuse of Israel's officers by corruption. They are, you might say, the means of the check and balance within the system that was God's holy people, Israel. But the prophets were not dissidents. They were not dissidents. They were not against institutional hierarchy. They were for it. And they were so much for it, they wanted it to be pure and uncorrupt. In our modern day, many people, of course, make much of being so-called dissidents. And in my opinion, that breeds an easy cynicism that means you don't have to blow the whistle when there is corruption. If you think all institutions are corrupt per se, why do anything? Only those who believe in institutions will fight for their purity, for their freedom from corruption, and that's what prophets were. It's a much abused term nowadays when people try to ally it with dissidents. They certainly were not. They were against dissidents because dissidents bred corruption. They wanted to see Israel cleansed of injustice and corruption because what they held to was this. They held that injustice and corruption was of the fallen world, and if you were of the fallen world, then you simply could not see or understand God or God's holy presence. And let's take, I think, the best example of this from all the prophets in the Old Testament, and that's Isaiah, the book of Isaiah. And what I want to do is to see how the divine, the artistic hand structures the text in order to create a work of beauty, of sublimity, of uncanniness. Now, in biblical criticism, it's often held that there are two or three Isaiahs, and the reason for that is this, because it certainly does seem that there's an earlier strata that is from Isaiah the prophet in the 8th century, but then there seems to be other sections, Deutro or 2nd Isaiah from the 7th, and Trito Isaiah from maybe the 6th or even 5th centuries. Now, I don't have a particular problem with that. I have a problem with the way in which they argue for it, because often it's simply based upon the idea of, well, there's too many direct prophecies, and we know prophecy doesn't happen, so it must have been written after the event. I think that's a very modernist, rationalist way, and I'm not too sure that one would argue so confidently about that today. But the reason why I don't have a problem with it is for this reason, because we know from the Bible there were schools of prophets that were organized, and that consequently, within the name of the great prophet Isaiah, I am sure that the inspiration worked to follow on from that. But that's not really, anyway, our point here. What our point is to see this incredible structure through all the book, through all of Isaiah, all 66 chapters. And I should also say here as well, the last 20 years, especially in studies of Isaiah, now focus on the incredible thematic unity of Isaiah, which is why, actually, some scholars argue it was written late and all by one person, because of the incredible unity. A position I'd disagree with, but be that as it may. I want to start with Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2. Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2. On that day the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and glory of the survivors of Israel. Now it's a prophecy, or it's a reasonable supposition, whatever you might say. What it's looking forward to or looking at is the idea that Israel, and it also means Judah within that, it actually predominantly means Judah, will be led off into exile, but nevertheless she will return in a glorious way from that exile. And he says, on that day the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and glory of the survivors of Israel. As I say, it's a prophecy of that return from wandering in exile. Remember last week that theme of wandering. Well, in Deuteronomy it says, they'll all apostatize, be taken off into exile to wander away from their land, but they'll be brought back. And this is further part of that. They'll be brought back. It's a prophecy of the return from the wandering and exile. But here I want to just point out something about the kind of way in which structure works in the Bible. You see, oftentimes the structure works by juxtaposition. You really must learn, when you're reading a Bible, not to expect editorial comment all the time. I think that's what Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, God rest his soul, think. They think that when the Bible talks about Lot's two daughters having sex with him, that therefore in some way the authors of the Bible approved of that. As if, well, it should always say, oh, by the way, we disapprove of this. Well, it's a rather Philistine view of how literature works. We must look at the structure, and it's very interesting to see how Isaiah 4:2 follows on from what precedes it in chapter 3, 1:26. This is what immediately precedes this. Now this is a denunciation of the present injustice and corruption in Judah. What has happened is, and it's a picture that's been painted, is it's a legal corruption, it's legal injustice. What's happened is that people have become very rich, a certain group, and what they're doing is putting up the rents and price of land and obviously other legal matters, and they're forcing the poor people around Jerusalem to have to sell their properties at a loss. And consequently, what the rich are doing are joining property to property and creating large estates. It's a legal corruption. And they're getting a lot of money from this. And they're showing their money in terms of things like jewelry, makeup, perfumes, and so on and so forth. In Judah, we read, they have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. You have devoured the vineyard. That's through the finances, have devoured the vineyard. And the spoil of the poor is in your houses. They grind the face of the poor. And the emblem is the rich decoration and jewelry on the daughters of Judah. And so it goes and talks about their perfume and so forth. And then it says in 24:26, no matter about their perfume, there will be no perfume, no rich robes, no luxury, no dainty appearances. Now they will be ugly. Largely because the Babylonians are going to come. Now they will be ugly. You see what the juxtaposition is? That's corruption. And everything is ugly. And that's beautiful. The juxtaposition is showing you in what consists the beauty, or at least in what is expressed the beauty. The narrative contrast brings out the way in which the world views beauty. Here, the riches, the daintiness, the perfumes, and all of that. The way in which the world views beauty, even though it's based upon corruption and the exploitation of the poor, and the way in which God shows beauty. You remember last week starting off by talking about the sense of beauty of holiness, the beauty of God, the beauty of the temple. The corrupt world views beauty in terms of riches and power and status. And yet, the beauty of God has to do with the vindication for the poor and vulnerable. In other words, judgment. Judgment is beautiful. The theme of the branch that we came at in 4:2 recurs through Isaiah. It recurs, and it's also entwined with the theme of a growing man, of which we're going to have a look at. Now, there's a very sophisticated use of this unfolding structure. And the question is, to what end? To what end? I mean, it's one thing to have a very sophisticated narrative structure. It's another thing entirely to say, well, good, and to what end? What is it trying to say through the way in which it orders its contents? I think the juxtaposition of Isaiah 3 and 4, an earthly corrupt beauty contrasted to divine beauty, hints at the answer. There's an exegetical prompt that's meant to make us read deeper, to journey deeper into the heart of the temple that is Scripture, or higher up the mountain, the holy mountain of Scripture. As Isaiah unfolds, the theme of the branch starts to become identified with the concept, with the conception, the birth, and then the growth to maturity of a child. But let's see where this conception begins. And here's another very interesting juxtaposition in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 6 is the one in which the prophet is commissioned. And if you remember, it goes like this. Isaiah finds himself in the cosmic holy of holies, the cosmic holy of holies of the temple. I'll just read it. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of the glory." And the foundations and thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. It's a cosmic temple. It's a temple in Jerusalem, but it's that cosmic form of it. Because God is there with the seraphim. It's not just a mere symbol. And that's where he's commissioned, in the cosmic holy of holies, in the very presence of the fullness of the glory of God. It's a majestic picture if you think about it. He is told to go out and preach, and he's told how it's all going to end in exile and waste. And in 6:13, this is really how his commission concludes. Israel will be like an oak whose stump remains standing when it has been cut down. The holy seed is its stump. Like an oak whose stump remains standing when it has been cut down, the holy seed is its stump. It's in 6:13. The theme there is, and it's a theme that recurs throughout Isaiah, these mighty trees of Lebanon and Israel, they get cut down, they're totally cut down, and yet out of one, out of this devastation, a little shoot starts to appear. And this will, of course, become the branch of the Lord. Here it says the holy seed is its stump. The basis of it is the holy seed. And something is to grow out of this vast and terrible removal. Later, in chapter 10, 34, and 11, 1 to 4, We read a little bit more. We hear about God. Behold, the Lord of hosts will lop the boughs with terrifying power. The great in height will be hewn down, and the lofty will be brought down. He will cut down the thickets of the forest with an axe, and Lebanon with its majestic trees will fall. And then in 11:1, we read this straight after. And then there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of the roots, and the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, and the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of the knowledge of the fear of the Lord, and his delight shall be in the Lord. In other words, that theme of the stump and the branch are brought together by reference to the holy seed, and it starts to refer to some figure. But let's return to Isaiah 6. Isaiah, as I pointed out, is commissioned in the cosmic holy of holies of the temple, in the very presence, the majestic presence, the seraphic presence of the very glory of God. Then see what happens in Isaiah 7. Isaiah 7 is actually the first part of the commissioning of Isaiah when he delivers a sign to King Ahaz. Now, the background is this. King Ahaz is king of Judah, and you remember last week I said that the Israel had divided into two, the southern Judah kingdom, the northern Israel kingdom, and they were often at war, and they're at war now. Ahaz is problematic. He knows Israel's going to invade, and in fact, they're in cahoots with Syria. So it's like, what the hell am I going to do? And Isaiah comes along and says, look, ask for a sign from the Lord. And Ahaz comes over all pious, obviously to dismiss the prophet. Far be it from me to tempt the Lord. I will not. And Isaiah says, well, it's not enough that you weary men. You must weary my God as well. Well, God is going to give you a sign. And of course, I hope we all know what that sign was. When we read in 7:14-16. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a young woman. Now, that term in Hebrew can mean virgin, but it can also mean young maiden. And I'll explain something about that in a minute. Behold, a young woman, a virgin, shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, meaning God with us. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child knows how to refuse evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread, northern kingdom and Syria, they will be deserted, meaning the Assyrians will come in. The sign that is given to Ahaz is a sign of a young pregnant woman, be her a young maiden or a virgin. In other words, what do you think Ahaz is going to say about, oh, well, great, that's really fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. He's obviously not concerned one bit. And there's no evidence whatsoever that he is. Because after all, he's more interested in military might, in God coming down, I guess, with angels or providing men that will destroy this. So what? Even if it is a virgin, yeah, sure, that's odd, but got better things to think of. The first sign of Isaiah's commissioning is a sign that the power of the world really couldn't care about, wouldn't even notice. Now, in Isaiah 6, in the commissioning, God says, you will preach to them and they will not understand. Hearing they will not hear, seeing they will not see. Of course, we'll come back to that next week. This is the point I want to bring out, though, about the juxtaposition. In heaven, the presence of God is this incredible glory. On earth, the presence of God is in a nondescript young woman who has just conceived. The principle is that the great things of heaven are at home in the small things on earth. That's a biblical principle. The great things of heaven, the very glorious presence of God, is at home in the small things of earth. Well, this is something obviously we're going to come back to. Now, this prophecy, of course, will be fulfilled in Our Lady. But that's the theme of prophecy. It doesn't just have one fulfillment, it actually often has a number. And clearly that has a fulfillment at that period, because it will be a sign that, you know, Israel and northern kingdom will be desolate before it can discern between good and evil. It also has, later in Isaiah, a theme of fulfillment in respect of Israel coming back from exile. That's what's called in prophecy recapitulation. It's like, remember that kind of pattern of circling going on. As was redemption, creation begins with the separation of waters. Exodus recapitulates that separation of waters. And in fact, baptism too recapitulates that in a fullest sacramental way. And so is this. It is a recapitulated, but it is fulfilled in Our Lady. That's why in the Hebrew, Alma can mean virgin and it can mean young maiden. But 300 BC in the Septuagint, it was a Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures made by Jews in Alexandria. 300 BC, they translated the Hebrew scriptures into Greek because most Jews couldn't read Hebrew. They actually translated that term into a term that means virgin. So what we see is a slow development and fulfillment of this. But at each stage, including with Our Lady, it's a small thing of earth. It's something that the great and mighty and powerful of earth don't even see. And you might wonder, and you might think about this. Perhaps some of you do know the name of who the king of Israel was at the time, or the king of Syria. Perhaps you also know the name of the great leader of one of the greatest empires the world has seen, the king of Assyria. You probably don't. And maybe some of you might remember who was the emperor of Rome at the time of Our Lady. Probably a lot of you don't. And yet, we all know the name of Our Lady. History tends to bear out the truth of God's dictum. So, the great things of heaven are at home in small things of earth. And the way in which the writers of the Bible present this is through juxtaposition. Isaiah 6, a glorious presence of God in heaven. Isaiah 7, Emmanuel, God with us, the presence of God in a fertilized egg. Well, God's might is his beauty. That's what we read last week. I put up in Psalm 110:3. God's might is his beauty. And as the world sees might as arbitrary power, it cannot conceive of or even understand the beauty of God. It thinks that God's presence should be like a mighty dictator. It thinks, I think, sometimes that God's presence should be like a mighty dictator or some incredible sort of alien being that's miles high. But I guess that's not the way God tends to appear. So this, what we've just read about the branch becoming a root that sort of comes out of the stump, everything's being decimated, and yet somehow this little bit of life starts to come out. And this little bit of life, of course, mirrors the fertilized egg in the pregnant woman. It mirrors that. Both mirror and they start to entwine. The child becomes a shoot, as it were, becomes a branch, becomes a tree, becomes the man. And what does this man look like? Well, in Isaiah 53:1-3, the very famous passage, who has believed what we have heard? That takes us back to the commissioning of Isaiah. Hearing they won't hear, seeing they won't see. It actually goes all through Isaiah. Who has believed what we have heard, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Arm of the Lord means might. And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or beauty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgression. Who has believed what we have heard? In other words, the world cannot. Because when the world sees this man who grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground, they saw no form or beauty in him. There's no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men. In other words, he was considered to be a total failure, a loser. He was one from whom men hide their faces. So no beauty according to the world's understanding. It is, of course, a suffering servant, of whom, obviously, we're going to come to next week when we come to the New Testament and our Lord. But when Isaiah asks in chapter 40, verse 18, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare him with? To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? Well, of course, that's contrasting to idols. Now, if you think about the logic of idols, I'm sorry, I tend to see them as the same kind of logic of ethics committees, to be honest. And that is, in ethics committees, of course, what you do, if you want to do something, and this is very much part and parcel you read in every day, something controversial will be posited, experimenting on human life. They call for submissions, and lo and behold, there are many different views. Some say yes, some say no, some say maybe. And then the ruling of the ethics committee is, gosh, we live in a pluralist society where there are so many different views. Well, it's very difficult. We'll do it anyway because it'll make profit and maybe heal the blind. We'll do it anyway, but we'll have safeguards and review it. It's the same thing with idolatry. If you read Isaiah, that's what happens. You multiply idols and you simply say, who can be sure? Who can be sure God said this? So many gods. Who can be sure? And that's what they did. That is how they justified injustice. Because after all, there are many gods. There is no moral absolute. Who can be sure? And given we live in pragmatic, free market, capitalist times, well, the economy rules, so we should be pragmatic. And it was no different then. In other words, when the prophet says, to whom then will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him? He's saying it's not idols. In other words, what it is, you could answer that, to whom will you liken God? To those who are most vulnerable to injustice. Of course, in the Torah and the prophets again and again, justice has as its essence the care for the orphan, for the poor, the vulnerable, the stranger in the land. To the most vulnerable, they're the vulnerable, the widow, the orphan, the stranger in the land. Today, the unborn, of course they're the most vulnerable. The refugee, they're the most vulnerable. In other words, to whom will we liken God? Well, in Isaiah it tells us, to a fertilized egg in the womb of a young woman, to a child to a shoot from a stump, to a tortured man who in fact seeks to bless others. In fact, to a tortured man whom, as it says elsewhere in Isaiah, looks for justice. The whole of Isaiah is an answer to that question. You want to know where God is? You want to know where God is today? In the aborted fetus and embryo. In the refugee. In those. In those poor Mexicans who are suffering from the cartels, but our nation included, buys the drugs that keep them under the hand of those cartels. Every time you buy a drug, be it dope or cocaine, you're supporting it all. You're crushing the vulnerable. And that's Isaiah's point. You want to know what it's to be likened? Well, in chapter 7 it tells you. A woman will conceive. There's God's presence. It'll be Emmanuel, God with us. It'll be a shoot, a child, to a tortured man who seeks justice and to bless others. I noted last week that God prohibits man from making an image of God, and yet God makes just such an image, humanity. And once a year, the high priest entered into the Holy of Holies, there would be an image of God. Well, here in Isaiah, by the use of juxtaposition, reversal of expectation, even irony, the image of God is slowly revealed, and thereby the very presence of God, God with us. And it's in the depth of the text. You have to read the text closely. You have to look at the structures, the juxtapositions. You have to actually be committed to the text. You can't do just an easy thing of saying, well, I pray to the Holy Spirit and I'm divinely illuminated. The Holy Spirit, it says in the New Testament, works through the church and works common grace through those scholars and commentators. This idea that you can read it for yourself is nothing more than a mere consumerist, I suppose, conceit. You have to really pay attention and be disciplined and journey through, because if you don't, you simply fall into kitsch. If we are to see the beauty of the Bible, we must work for it. We must be humble. Listen to the church, to all the great commentators, and of course to many of the scholars, many of whom are secular scholars today, who, be they secular or religious, are often the means by which, I would argue, by which God's Holy Spirit enlightens us. We depend on others. If we think the vision of beauty is easy, then we will be deluded by the consumer world into believing in kitsch. And if so, then we will not only ignore the cry of the vulnerable, but we will also see the suffering and the just one, the tortured one. We won't see them as beautiful because they bear the presence of God, but as ugly to be avoided. As Jesus said in John chapter 5, verse 44, how can you have faith when rather than seek the glory of God, you seek the glory of men? How can you have faith when rather than seek the glory of God, you seek the glory of men? Next week, to round it up, we're coming to St. John's Gospel and the theme of the temple and the mountain and so forth, and we'll also return to the theme of Isaiah and, of course, the Akedah to Genesis 22. But to finish up in reference to the Akedah, in the Akedah, we see something terrifying, something mystifying, something altogether sublime and uncanny, and yet there is something incredibly beautiful about Genesis 22 for all of that. It's probably one of the most important texts in contemporary philosophy. For example, Jacques Derrida in The Gift of Death wrote a whole work engaging with Kierkegaard's reading and the Bible and pointed out just how much it forms a focal point of European identity. And it's, as I say, the Cardinal's point at the beginning of this year at the opening Mass at the Catholic Institute when this was a reading, and his expression of dismay at it and incomprehension at it. That's a right response, because I think the response of Jews in the Old Testament was like incomprehension. And yet when we come to the New Testament, of course, suddenly something, another light is shed upon this story, upon this tale. And that light is the same kind of light that obviously comes as well via the Isaiah's suffering servant, of whom we've touched a little upon today. All of this is leading us to the Holy of Holies of the Bible. And the Holy of Holies of the Bible, of course, is that part of the text when each year at Easter we kneel when we hear about and read about the death of our Lord on the cross. But as I say, we'll come to that next week and I'll finish here.
This was a talk by Dr. Robert Tilley entitled "The Big Things of Heaven Find a Home in the Small Things on Earth, The Prophets and the Unexpected." This was the first of three talks from Dr. Tilley's series, The Beauty and Inspiration of the Bible. For more, visit cradio.org.au.